That's a lot of f***ing cards. Jesus
Christ.
We
have got a lot to get through.
She's not even flicked one over yet. We're still on the first page.
She is the only person that you allowed yourself to be vulnerable with.
The kind of last impression that she may have of me is like she'd let me down. And she never did, not once.
She knew you better probably than you knew yourself.
I will never have a connection with another human the way that I did with her. I couldn't express anything else. I didn't know what to do.
How bad did it get?
But I couldn't relax, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't do anything unless I had a drink. And it wasn't a crutch, it was a necessity. I don't feel like anyone as romantically has ever actually really been in love with me.
Makes me sad that you've never felt like really loved.
In terms of what is bringing me kind of joy at the minute, I'm still searching for that.
I want to speak about your friendship with Sam.
Do you know what? If I'm really honest, I never expected us to become as close as what we are. I've needed and need Sam more than he needs me.
Welcome back to Rise with Roxy. Today's guest is the definition of someone who is unapologetically themselves. He stepped into the public eye through The Only Way is Essex, but underneath the inked tough exterior is a man who isn't afraid to be vulnerable. Whether that's with best friend and podcast host Sam Thompson, appearing on Strictly, or confronting his past on SAS Who Dares Wins. We're diving into grief, loss, loyalty, and letting go of masculine labels. Get ready to rise with someone who's rewriting what it means to be vulnerable in the public eye. Pete, welcome to Rise with Roxy.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Lovely little set.
Loving the brown.
Yeah.
You look delightful.
You've come actually perfectly in your the tones.
Well, I specifically did it. Yeah, I went neutral tones. Yeah, because I looked at the set and I thought I need to blend in.
I thought so. Yeah. No, I love it.
Thank you.
And you're comfy.
I'm very comfy. It's
We're
a lovely
ready to
scene.
Open you up today.
Good luck with that, darling. People have been trying for years. She can write me up like a tin of beans. It's going to be a fucking nightmare, isn't it?
He's going to be crying his way out of here. Okay, Pete, I want to start with TOWIE, okay? So the only way is,
hell.
I know.
Right, where do
go.
I leave? Yeah.
The only way is Essex. This is, I guess, how people first found out who you were.
Yeah.
Now, how did you actually come to get on the show? Like, who were you before that?
I had a real job and a career before I decided to become a bum. And I worked in the city for years, and I was like an international sales director for a medical recruitment company. So we used to supply consultant doctors all over the world and that. And then I left to do it alone and was on holiday, and someone I know was on the show and sort of accidentally just rocked up one day drunk.
Right.
And did a scene for a laugh and then never left. And I just thought, I'd worked so hard, like all my life. I felt like I needed a year off and just to have a bit of fun. And that's what I thought it would be. And then it evolved.
What was there an appeal to you in being in the public eye?
No, not at all. I hate it and still do 10, 11
Do you really?
Years later, yeah.
What do you hate about it?
I'm quite private, which sounds mad considering what I do, but that's why I don't ever film at my house. I don't really film with family. I don't like, I keep that side.
That is
my life. So I kind of probably built like a caricature of what people think I am for the TV. And then it doesn't really matter what anyone says about that because it's not really me.
So how quickly on your journey with TOWIE did you form this persona?
It was probably just a more exaggerated version of probably all my worst traits, I think would probably be the way to describe it. But I never took it seriously. It wasn't a career.
Your relationships sort of played out on TV in a very, very public way. For someone who's said that you like privacy, were you able to actually stay authentic in your romantic relationships?
Because I wasn't really taking it seriously, I didn't think anyone would really care about what was actually happening in a relationship until everything goes wrong and then suddenly you're public enemy number one, which happened quite a lot, but fully deserved. I was a prick.
How did that kind of label of being, let's say, a love rat actually affect you on the inside during that time?
It didn't really affect me what people were saying because, you know, people that don't know me, I don't really care. But the problem is I was hurting people that I did care about. That affects me. Because really, the you know, having your kind of dirty laundry aired in public when it's someone you care about and them having to go through that. I don't really give a monkey's what people say about me. I mean, at the time, people were building kind of dolls of me and setting them alight and hanging them from
lampposts. Really?
I was getting death threats and, yeah, like nonstop.
Death threats?
Yeah. I still get them now.
No.
Yeah.
God, that's awful.
Yeah, it's not right, but yeah. It is what it is. And I think I've always been fairly thick-skinned with that sort of stuff. But when it starts affecting, you know, the people that I do care about, that's when it bothers me. And, you know, I did a lot of things wrong. I've made an awful lot of mistakes that I will never forgive myself for because I hurt a lot of people.
What drove you to make those choices?
You know, I don't think anything drove me to it other than the fact that I was emotionally immature. I made the wrong decisions and I didn't think things through. So there is absolutely no way I'm going to blame anything on what I did or what I've done.
No, and I think, look, I definitely don't think it's about making excuses, and I love how accountable you are. It's also about being able to be compassionate to yourself about perhaps what pain you were in that was driving that, if there was any.
Up until, you know, a few years ago, I probably didn't realize how much pain I was probably in personally anyway. I think it's just I had learned a way of dealing with things and surviving as me, but a lot of that was because I hadn't dealt with an awful lot of things and you know, I was just very, very selfish.
I think that when we are in relationship to other people, it can be friendship.
I wouldn't know, darling. They never stick around for long enough.
Look at you trying to deflect with humour.
For fuck's sake.
When we are in relationship to other people, you know, especially romantic ones, I think it's like the biggest mirror we have to ourselves. And I think we learn so much about ourselves, all the good bits, the bad bits, the insecure bits. What do you think some of your relationships have taught you about yourself?
Good question. I haven't been in a lot of conventional relationships because I have always had a fairly obvious avoidance of commitment. And I always thought that was just because, you know, I would rather be on my own and I would rather, you know, do things on my own, and I was fine on my own because I'd always kind of been on my own. I'd always been very independent and done things. But actually, it's got nothing to do with that. I think it's pretty standard, what do they call it, attachment avoidance or whatever the fuck it is. Pretty standard textbook shit. But a lot of that is down to the fact that I never really wanted the responsibility of someone else's emotions, because I always assumed that I would probably let them down at some point. So it was better for me to leave than let someone down. But in terms of what kind of relationships have taught me is I was never ready to be in one. I don't think any of the women that I'd ever dated ever really loved me, because they only really got half of me. You can't fall in love with half a person. So because I always kept a lot back, I think people fell in love with the idea of me and not actually who I am or was, because they never saw it. Which is different now, because I'm in a different point in my life now, where actually, you know, I am fine on my own, and I'm good being on my own, but I don't want to be on my own. I'm so, so blessed and grateful to do a lot of things that I do. But a lot of that is pretty pointless unless you've got someone to share that with.
Yeah. Oh, I actually feel really emotional.
Why?
Because
I thought you were going to make me cry.
Oh, yeah. Because I think to hear you say that you don't feel like anyone's really loved you for all of you because you've never seen that, it just makes me sad that you've never felt like really loved truly. And I think even though for you, I suppose what you're saying is that's because you never allowed someone to see you. To me, it speaks of, and I might be wrong, but that you maybe feared, as well as fearing letting someone down, maybe part of that fear was feeling that if you showed someone all of you, they would leave.
I've had two people in my life that have just adored the bones off me no matter what. And they weren't romantic relationships. That was my nan and my mum. And I'm so blessed to have had that. But they kind of have to, because they're my mum and my nan. They don't really have a choice. But they know an awful lot about me, like specifically my nan. But I just think when it comes to romantic relationships, I don't feel like anyone has romantically has ever actually really been in love with me. I can't see how they could do, because if I've never really liked myself, then how can anyone love it?
What do you think are some of the parts of yourself you'd like to show somebody?
Don't really want to show anyone anything. do you know what? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I've never really thought about what I want to show people. I just want to make people feel better. You know, I don't ever want to be a burden on someone, and I don't ever want people to come away from being around me and feel worse than they did when they met me.
It sounds to me like this: you put so much pressure on yourself to be enough for everybody else. And like, I hear it in everything that you're saying, and you keep coming back to it. Do you not see how you do leave people feeling so good? You do, like, you are such a good person.
No, I don't feel that. Do you know what it is? It's really difficult, I think, because and I'm sure everyone has got the same thing, but I had, you know, someone in my life who was just the best person you could ever imagine. And I saw the way everyone was around her and being around her. And that feeling that she gave other people and certainly gave me, that is a blessing. It's a gift. It's a gift to be able to do that. And I'm not blessed with that gift, but what I can do is keep trying. You know, sometimes you know, I have seen the amount of hurt I've caused people before. And so no amount of making someone else feel better is going to make up for that. So you just have to keep going.
I feel like some self-forgiveness would be really healing, if I may say.
You may say, I may not respond.
You've spoken.
That's a lot of fucking cards. They can't all be for me. Jesus
Christ.
We
have got a lot to get through.
She's fucking joking. Look at the fucking size of that. I'm not that interesting. What the fuck is wrong with you lot? Jesus Christ.
We've got lots of topics to get through.
My God, she's not even flicked one over yet. We're still on the first page. I've got like fucking things to do tonight. Christ, no wonder it's a fucking 12 o'clock record. Fucking hell. I said I was going back to the office. I ain't going to make it.
I don't think so, no. Having fun?
Flick a card. Jesus.
I just flicked one, for fuck's sake. Right, you've spoken about struggling with anger.
Yeah, fucking hell. What a prime segue that was.
What do you think it was protecting?
Everything. I found... I never really understood how I was feeling or emotions. I never really understood myself or how to deal with anything. So it all kind of presented itself with anger, and it to the point where anger became comfortable. And I think that's the most dangerous thing, is that it became more comfortable to be angry than it did to not be angry.
And what was your expression of anger, like using your voice?
It depends. It depends. Lots of different things. But, you know, I wasn't a particularly well-behaved younger man. And it would be 0 to 100 real fucking quick. But it was because I couldn't express in any other way. I didn't really understand. And actually, a lot of the time, it wasn't even because I was angry. A lot of the time, it was through sadness, or it was through, you know, loneliness or frustration or anything really. But the easiest go to and the only thing that kind of felt natural was to be angry. So something would piss me off. And actually, it wasn't really something that pissed me off, but it was a way to kind of expel the frustrations. And dogs do a similar thing. It's a displacement. It's basically a displacement of how I was feeling, because I didn't know what to do. It was like shaking it off, get angry, lose my temper. And it was like a reset, because there were so many emotions that I didn't understand and didn't know what to do with, that it would come out in that way to enable me to kind of reset, which is just a real fucking dangerous and nasty way to be.
Was there a moment where your own anger really scared you or made you feel like, shit, I've got to change something here?
Yeah. There is one thing that again, and it's saying I will never forgive myself for, but that really thought, this is not how to express how you feel. And that was when my nan was dying. She'd said to me, she was ill for a really long time, and the last 3 weeks she was in hospital, and she always used to say, I can't go until you're happy. And the day that she died, she effectively said, I can't do it anymore. And I got fucking angry. I was like, well, you can't fucking, you can't leave. You can't go. Because I didn't know how else to, I couldn't, I was angry. Like, I was angry, like as if she was leaving me, but she, you know, she was fucking dying, man. I couldn't express anything else. I didn't know what to do. And, you know, when, after she'd gone, I completely lost the plot. And that was because, you know, I wasn't angry, but I felt angry at her because she wasn't here anymore. And that was, you know, completely out of her control. But I didn't know how else to feel. I couldn't understand anything else. Mm. And that, the kind of last impression that she may have of me is, like she'd let me down, and she never did, not once.
Yeah. She will know that. She knew you better probably than you knew yourself, and she would have known exactly where that anger was coming from. I'm sure of that. What happened in the weeks that followed? What did losing the plot feel like for you?
It's kind of a bit of a hazy period. Mm. I did, you know, my response to kind of anything is just stay busy, crack on, move on, keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to do that, but, you know, for months and months and months, it was cracking on and then beating myself up privately for, you know, a lot of different things. You know, I was just nonstop the saddest, the loneliest I've ever been. But I didn't talk to anyone. I didn't, you know, I just used to go home and just be sad and lonely on my own. Because I didn't want it to be, you know, listen, it's one of them things, and I say it all the time, because years after, and the thing that I always seem to speak about is my nan, and everyone loses grandparents. It's not, you know, it's no different to anything else. And, you know, I was blessed to have her for so many years, and people have never had that opportunity. I know how lucky I am. But, we're years after, and I still can't process it, and I'm still lonelier than I ever have been. Because she was my safety net. She was the only, you know, person that I've ever fully relied on that has never ever let me down. And then it's a case now of trying to learn to be your own safety net, which I always thought I was, but actually I wasn't. I was more unstable and emotionally fucking stunted than I thought. But I thought because I'd do everything independently, and that meant I was fine and I could handle anything. As it turns out, I'm weaker than I ever thought I was.
I think you said, you know, lots of people lose their grandparents, right? And that's true. But I think it's not the same as losing just a grandparent, because for you, it sounds like she is the only person that you allowed yourself to be vulnerable with. And that was that you saw all of you. And so I think it is going to leave such a hole in your life. And I can't even imagine the pain of that.
I mean, the last thing she said to me was that that I was her soulmate. And I fully believed that. You know, there's a, you know, people automatically assume soulmates are in a kind of intimate relationship type thing.
And yeah,
it's not the case. She was my best friend. She was my soulmate. I will never have a connection with another human the way that I did with her, you know.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you can't have, you know, other wonderful connections and stuff with people, but she was just everything.
She sounds amazing.
Yeah, she was.
Do you still feel her around you now?
Yeah.
Aww.
Not enough.
Yeah.
But it will never be enough. But yeah, there's you know, it has an impact, and you know, a lot of things around my life. You know, any time that I do anything that I'm semi happy with, I wish I could tell her. I wish she was there. Anytime I do anything bad or I'm not sure, or I don't know, I wish I could ask her.
It's hard.
But, it's you hard. Know.
Did you notice growing up that it was not kind of okay for men to speak how they feel, or do you think it was more specific to you and your personality? No,
I mean, I think generationally, certainly I'm you know, I'm 37, and I think generationally I was probably, the, you know, one of the last generations where, no, man's got to be a man.
Yeah.
You don't cry. You provide.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of how I was kind of brought up. And that's not specific because, you know, I had, you know, male influences that were really, really like that. I think that was kind of even how women kind of thought. And certainly in the last couple of years, it's completely different. I would never speak like this.
Yeah.
Ever at all until I did the book. And, you know, before that, I just wouldn't speak about things because it's not really anyone else's problem. I should be able to sort it myself, and I should be able to deal with that myself. And, you know, I don't need help. I've never needed help because I can do it. And if I can't do it, why can't I do it? What's wrong with me? I should be better. That was kind of how I kind of saw things, and part of me still fights that now.
Yeah.
Even though I know that that's wrong.
Yeah.
But it's you know, changing is difficult because it's a commitment. It's a commitment to change. If you don't commit to change, then you're not going to do it.
Yeah. I think so much of growing is a constant practice of allowing yourself to be vulnerable. Like for me, so much of it comes down to that. And even, you know, I was massively avoidant, really hate asking for people for help. So I can, you know, partly relate in that sense.
Are you still like that now?
I'm really genuinely practicing. So it's, for example, I really, really needed a friend of mine in the last couple of weeks. She's like one of my closest friends, and we've had a really good dynamic always. And I had a really shit couple of weeks, and I relied on her massively, and I had to keep calling her. And after it, I immediately thought, well, that's it. That's the end of our friendship. She's going to see me differently. She'll think I'm weak. She won't like me anymore. So my instinct was to ignore her, not ignore her, but step back from her, because I thought, well, I've fucked it now anyway. And so I had to fight against that instinct and actually reach out and stay close. And we went for a walk on Friday, and I was like, that is where healing happens, when you do something differently and you realize people still love you, even if you need them.
Yeah. It's, you know, I imagine if anyone listens to this podcast or watch this podcast, I don't think they would imagine you and I would have any similarities. But as it turns out, I think we've probably got more than we.
So many. Yeah. But, many.
But yeah, completely. I completely understand that way of thinking.
Yeah.
Because that would exactly be the same. It would be for me. Fuck. They've seen something that I'm not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave.
Yeah.
Because then I haven't got to deal with facing up to the fact that I needed someone or I had a moment that made me feel weak or vulnerable.
Yeah. But the trick is, when you have the tendency to do that, to run, is to stay. And that will be where everything will begin to shift.
It's so weird, because I think one of the only traits that I possess that I would consider, you know, a good thing is that I never run when someone needs me. I run when I need people.
Yeah.
Which is really, really odd, because, you know, anyone around me that I love, they could do anything.
Yeah.
And I would be there.
Yeah.
You know, turning up and being present is more important than anything else. But yeah, I cannot allow people to be there for me. And I won't even be there for myself a lot of the time, which is just fucking madness. And that's where the change needs to happen.
Yeah.
For both of us, by the sounds of it. So I'm going to practice with that with you.
Good. We can hold each other accountable.
Just fucking hell.
You got a tattoo at 15, which is never enough.
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean to you when you got it? And what does it mean to you now?
I was a deep child. What did it mean to me? It meant that I could get into nightclubs. Not a lie. I was going to nightclubs at a lot of my mates were kind of older. So I had it kind of so that, you know, if you ever queue up with a bouncer and you just put your arm, they've got a toe. And then
I see.
Because the beard at 12 wasn't enough. but never enough. I don't really remember the reason why I had that. I think subconsciously it might have been something I needed, like a fucking, I just wanted a bit of writing type thing.
Right.
And it was the first kind of thing that popped in mind, and I don't fully know why. I honestly don't.
Wow.
And actually what it's become is pretty much how I've lived my life.
Do you think having that tattooed on you subconsciously exacerbated that feeling of never being enough?
I mean, Roxy, you know I love you, but as we've discussed before, I don't always follow the theories with you. I'm just so happy that you've not mentioned manifestation so far.
Fuck you.
but I honestly, there probably is something in it. I think what I've had throughout my life is a selective memory where I tend to not remember the things that I don't want to.
Yes.
I try and do that.
Your brain trying to protect you.
Yeah, a little bit. Same as I've never had a dream.
You've never had a dream?
I've never had a dream. Well, I say this, everyone dreams. So everyone dreams in their REM sleep and all the rest of it. I've never had a dream I remembered. Ever. Nothing. Ever.
Ever.
Ever. Don't remember ever having a good dream, bad dream, nothing. Not even a wet one. I honestly don't, yeah.
Oh.
So I don't know. I don't know genuinely.
Wait, have you spoken to any like psychotherapists about this?
Yeah, someone like a sleep therapist once told me that a lot of the reason is subconsciously it's you protecting yourself because you may have had an awful lot of bad dreams or something along those lines, and it's your brain trying to protect you from having that, so it blocks everything.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I think there's definitely something.
But also,
to
I don't
it.
Sleep a lot either, so my sleep is I've been like an.
I really want you to get an aura ring, so we can figure out your sleep.
Do you? Have you got an aura ring?
Yeah. Oh my god, I've just got one.
But what does it do?
Well, it's told me that I sleep absolutely fucking terribly, and I thought I was like a beauty
surely
queen.
You know that.
No, I thought I was a really good sleeper. I don't sleep. I don't go into deep
sleep.
Well,
I don't need a fucking ring to tell me. I know because I'm tired every fucking day.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm still awake at 3 a.m.
Are you still?
Yeah, I sleep maybe 3 hours a night.
No, Pete, that's not.
That's
good.
Why I look like this. I'm only 17.
Right, alcohol. Let's talk about your relationship with alcohol. When did you first start drinking?
Young. I started working like fairly young, and I worked in a hotel, and a lot of people were older than me. And so, yeah, I used to go to a lot of nightclubs and pubs and shit from like 14, 15 with a lot of older people and sort of socially drank quite a lot. And I think really from kind of 17 onwards, it became a crutch in the period of my nan being ill and the period after. It wasn't a crutch. It was a necessity.
How bad did it get?
Always very functional, which is sometimes, I think, more dangerous than anything. But I couldn't relax. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do anything unless I had a drink in it. Because it was, but you know, a lot of the reason around drinking, I'm not a binge drinker, you know, it's like, and I never really got drunk. You know, I was never messy or I was never anything else unless I was on my own when, you know, I've had periods of, you know, falling down the stairs and waking up at the bottom of the stairs on my own and fucking not even realizing and then kind of just cracking on and getting on with things. But I think for me, it was more just about trying to numb feelings. You know, aside from kind of being angry, numbing that meant that I didn't get angry.
Right.
Because I didn't really feel anything.
Right.
Because I didn't really feel a lot. So it was I felt more stable. So, yeah.
Do you think that... That was there sort of this persona of being like the fun person out.
Party Pete.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I've always been quite a confident person. You know, some people drink for confidence and whatever else. It was never really about that for me. I just always wanted everyone to have kind of a good time. And I think I couldn't have a good time myself because my brain always overthinks and you know, it kind of is just a bit messy and chaotic. But then having a drink gave me kind of a way for me to kind of be involved and enjoy things because I didn't feel anything.
Mm.
So, you know, that kind of wanting to turn up and make people happy and be the guy that would get the party started and make sure everyone had a good time. I couldn't do that if, you know, feeling the way that I did a lot of the time. Yeah. But I could do that if I was drinking because I wasn't feeling that way. I was numbed to it all. So it enabled me to be the guy that people wanted and not the guy that I was.
How were you kind of like functioning at work whilst, like, were there times you were having to drink to get to work? Were there like some terrible hangovers that just felt like unbearable?
I wasn't in a position where I'd wake up with the fucking shit. Like, you know, and there's a massive difference between alcohol, which is a physical reaction to desperately needing it in terms of shakes and everything else, and then mentally needing it. I think there is a difference there. And for me, it wasn't a case of needing it to kind of get out of bed and go to work. And, you know, that's a horrendous consuming position to be in. But for me, it was a case of I needed it to manage who I was at the time. So it would become a lot easier anytime I would feel anything other than stable, I'd drink.
Right.
To stabilize and find some sort of equilibrium again.
When you did Strictly, you stopped drinking for that whole time. Was that the longest you'd gone without drinking?
Yeah.
And how did it feel? Like, I have friends who are very functional addicts and would say that they are not addicts, but they are. And she is often complaining that she's overwhelmed and stressed, right? And she doesn't realize that the booze are making her feel that way. She genuinely doesn't put two and two together at all. Did you have that experience or anything like that when you gave up, or not really?
I would love to tell you yes. But for me, what I had during the time was something else that was consuming. I had something to concentrate and focus on. And I think that is the thing for me. So I needed clarity during that period.
Yeah.
And I think what you do when you don't drink as much, like, I drink now, like, you know, I can go, but I don't use it as a numbing agent to life. And I think that's the difference. You know, it's not like I've suddenly become teetotal or any of that sort of stuff. But what it enabled me to do was stop living in a world that is hazy. And I think that's important because, you know, without clarity and kind of clear thinking, then you don't really reflect on you. You don't really reflect on the relationships you're having. You don't reflect on where you're going or what you're doing at that time. You don't feel present. You're not living in the moment because that moment is a cloud and a foggy mess. And, you know, sometimes that for me was what I feel like I probably needed to be in at the time, but actually I felt like I was a better person. You know, it was like a fucking superpower.
Yeah.
Which is mental because I'm a really great drunk. Like, I'm such a nice guy when I'm drunk.
You are doing like a million and one things at the moment. And every time I speak to you or I look at your Instagram, there is something else huge on, whether it's like the podcast, the books, the shows, all the hilarious content with Sam, which I want to move on to. What do you think is driving that like need for success and to keep working so much? Because I do think there's always something that drives it. What is it for you?
I'm not like a particularly educated person, but I love learning. Like and I love trying things, but more than anything, it's I need a purpose. I need a purpose. I don't know what my kind of purpose is, and you know, some of those things are things that are just work, and some of those things are passions. And a lot of the time, what I do work-wise enables me to fulfill passions, and I think that's probably why I work. You know, I do an awful lot of things that I don't necessarily enjoy. but I do it because it enables me to do the things that I do enjoy or that mean something to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many things that mean something to me and so many things that I want to do that I believe are putting me on a path to making some sort of impact.
Mm.
And I don't want to leave this world without having some sort of impact,
mm.
even if it's on one person. And you know, I will keep doing that until I feel like I've got some sort of peace of mind.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that purpose.
That was deeper than it needed to be, wasn't it?
You quite enjoying being deep, Pete?
No, I'm not, actually.
Are you actually not?
I'm always uncomfortable.
Do you feel uncomfortable, like yeah?
Yeah, but it's about getting comfortable being uncomfortable. Yeah.
Can you see the benefits of it?
Yes.
Good.
Yes, I can. Mm. Yeah, I can. And look, it's one of them things that I don't often like to put myself in positions like this,
mm-hmm.
but you have to.
Mm-hmm.
You Absolutely. Have to. You know, parts of it are cathartic and whatever else. And also I have so much admiration and respect for you that it would be wrong for me to come here and not do that.
Thank you. And I think also as someone, you know, for you, it's really important to leave an impact on people, help people feel good. And I think that, you know, part of the way that we can make people feel good is by entertaining them, part is by making them feel heard and feel seen. And by being vulnerable, you offer that part to other people. You know, you're very good at entertaining people and putting a smile on people's face. You're very good at also showing vulnerability is so healing for people that are at home, feeling lonely, feeling in pain, feeling unable to express themselves. And to know that somebody that they look up to or admire, or even just that another man is feeling that way too, you just can't underestimate how life-changing that can be for someone.
See, I never really understood that until the book.
Mm-hmm.
I never really, you know, that was kind of a cathartic experience for me, and also it was with the blessing of my mum, because a lot mm-hmm. of it is kind of her story, and she's my fucking hero from coming from the kind of pits of hell where she was to the person she is now. Growing up, I probably felt a lot alone in the way I felt, not understanding how I felt, not understanding how to label my emotions or understand what they were, and letting everything build up until this kind of catalyst of anger, because I didn't really speak to anyone. And there's a lot of people that don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So actually sometimes, you know, even if it's someone you don't know, having that kind of relatable thing that I'm okay because it's not just me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that by speaking about them things or sharing an experience, mm. even a kind of a public or an open forum, that actually it can impact on other people. Mm. And I was kind of quite overwhelmed and blown away by the response from the book.
Yeah.
And that is part of why Man Made came in, like the podcast. And it's because it's not just about my waffle.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's about letting people take a minute and reflect on why they may be feeling a certain way and not be consumed in the way that some people have been.
Yeah. How has Man Made been, by the way? And what are some of the things that you've learned on that journey?
We've had lots of interesting guests, male and female, and everyone's got a brother, husband, father, all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's not about how to be a good man, which is madness, because actually really that's what the tagline is.
Mm-hmm.
But actually what I've learned through the first series is a lot of it is just how to be a good person,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of gender. One of the things we ask people on the podcast is you know, about role models. Mm-hmm. I couldn't think of any male role models.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's fucking shit, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And I think what actually I've learned is that it doesn't have to be a male role model,
mm.
any kind of role model, because it's about being a good person.
Yeah.
You know, we've had so many different people who have come on from all different kind of backgrounds who have given their kind of what they think it takes to be a good man. And really that question is, what does it take to be a good person? Mm. Because they're translatable kind of traits that any gender can have. And a lot of that comes down to empathy, compassion, kindness. And we've had all sorts of different things, and it's been really, really interesting. I've been really blessed to have guests who have come on and been vulnerable and who have, you know, put themselves sometimes out of their comfort zones, all with the same thing, which is to anyone that's listening, to kind of help them potentially understand themselves or understand the world we live in, because it is a fucking scary place.
I want to speak about your friendship with Sam. My first kind of proper introduction to you was on Instagram in lockdown.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So if you knew who I was, what was your first impression before you met me?
I think before...
What did you think of me before you met me?
Well, I just thought he was the hot, towy bad boy.
Pick that up.
And then I saw your videos with Sam, and I was so...
And then thought, no, he's that hairy, grumpy old prat.
No, and I was, shut up and stop insulting yourself.
God, has she ever told anyone to shut up before? No. Scary, isn't she?
And I watched these videos, and firstly, I was so fucking shocked to see you and Sam Thompson together. I thought it must be like a setup. I thought it was a joke, because I was like, you just would never put you two together. And it was so laugh out loud funny, like absolutely genius. Please tell me, like, how did this friendship form, and how, when did you start doing these videos?
How did it form? Sam and I did a show together, and then he attached himself to me like a limpet to a rock.
What show was it?
Celebs Go Dating. do you know what? It's mad because Sam and I tell the stories very, very differently, because Sam says that he instantly met me and knew we'd be best friends. I thought I met him on the show, but apparently I'd met him several times before and didn't remember.
A selective memory of yours.
Yeah, it's that selective memory. Do you know what? If I'm really honest, I never expected us to become as close as what we are, because I found him quite funny, but I found him to be fucking annoying, really, for quite a long time. And actually, he was persistent and wore me down to actually, I think a lot of people were confused by the fact that they think Sam is this kind of, what's the saying that they use, like a Labrador Golden Retriever energy, and he's like that all the time. And actually, he's not. There is so much more to that boy. And one thing I will say about Sam is that he's one of the most genuine and authentic people that I know, because that is just him. You know, even in the last couple of years, when it's come to, you know, diagnosed with ADHD and autism and all the rest of it, he's learned to understand himself a little better. And really, for him, he's such a special person, because what we do, like the videos and all the rest of it, is for Sam. It's because he genuinely loves doing that. He genuinely loves it. And a lot of the reason that he loves it is because he enjoys doing it at the time. But what matters a lot to Sam, and he says it repeatedly, and he gets kind of quite emotional about it, is the response he gets from that, is the fact that it takes people away from whether they've had a shit day or whatever else, just to see something that is just lighthearted and fun and funny, and an opportunity for people to go, fucking hell. And he loves that. He genuinely adores that. And you know, a lot of the reason that I do it is for Sam, because I love him, and I do it for the way it makes him feel, because the way it makes him feel means everything to me.
Do you think having that friendship and learning to be like close with Sam has helped you become more open emotionally?
Sam's made me a better man. I think more than anything, I've needed and need Sam more than he needs me. There is nothing that I can do for him to give back what he's given me. And that is, despite all of his many, many, many faults, I know that if I needed him, he'd be there. And that is such a powerful feeling. That he's so authentically himself.
Yeah.
He's never judged me. And I think that's really important. He never judges me for anything I do. He puts up with me, because that is a fucking struggle to put up with me the way we do. We've got a business together. Mm. I'm a control freak. I'm a fucking nightmare. I'm moody. I'm lots of things. And he just carries on and accepts me for the way I am. And I don't think a lot of people have ever, or I've ever really felt like anyone has ever really properly done that. So I couldn't be more thankful to him for that, because sticking around is tough, and he has done that, and I believe he will always do that. And the fact that he's quite open and quite vulnerable, mm-hmm. and you know, will talk about his emotions has made me see that that is a better way of being.
It's so touching. I think that, like, friendships like that are really hard to come by.
Yeah.
And I think what you've described is so genuine. And it's just that feeling of, I think it's like really in many ways how you describe your nan, is having someone that just loves you unconditionally, that doesn't judge you, that is there for you. And I wonder, maybe Sam is one of your soulmates too, you know, and
that's
in many
a frightening
ways.
Thought. That is absolutely frightening.
Don't tell Sam I said that.
Yeah, do you know what? I think it's probably a case of what we give each other is very, very different.
Mm.
You know, but my weaknesses are a lot Sam's strengths, and
yeah.
vice versa.
I think friendship, like finding, like, I don't know, for me personally, hearing you describe that friendship, I'm like, it sounds... like, I would love to have a friendship like that.
You can borrow him.
I think finding true friendship like that is not easy for people, especially today, especially with social media. It's really not easy.
And I'm going to be really honest, is that genuinely, as much as you take the piss, that's down to Sam's persistence.
Mm.
Because although I liked him, I'd have quite happily let him walk out and, you know, become an acquaintance.
Yeah.
But he...
ground you down.
Oh, fucking did he, yeah. Mm. I mean, he wore me down, and I'm so thankful that he did,
yeah.
because although I kind of liked the geezer, it's you know, we kind of did a show, and then that would have been that.
Yeah.
Because I'm better on my own. But
well, he had to do some work to prove to you that you could open up based on maybe your own struggle with vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a fucking weird friendship, but...
Why do you think people love you both so much?
Because we are so different personality-wise. There's something for everyone.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's
like,
true.
I'm very opinionated and set in my ways about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam is just kind of that guy that you don't quite understand, but you want to be around.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, he... you can't help but smile around Sam.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think people kind of loved that. And then I'm there for the home truths and the and the saying things out loud that people don't want to say out loud.
And you've got your live show coming up.
Yeah.
In September.
So we did a tour last year, which was wild. And it was because Sam wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a typical Sam thing. So we did some dates, and then we added more dates, and then we did kind of a second kind of mini tour and did like a little residency at the Apollo, and it all did so well. And then Sam on stage on the last night of the Apollo said, next year we're doing the O2. We hadn't spoken about it.
Mm.
It wasn't going to be a thing. So I booked it and surprised him with the O2, and then, well, we're going to have to do it now. But we didn't really know how we'd get on, and just a couple of fucking wallies. Like big interesting people have done it, and then there's going to be me and him on the fucking stage at the O2, and I just don't know. I mean, it's going to be a lot, but I'm so excited. And you know what, like, one of the other kind of beautiful things about Sam and I and everything we do is that this kind of mad little journey that we're on is I get to share that with my best mate, and that's
yeah.
a really special thing. And you know, as much as it's going to be a fun night, I imagine it'll be quite an emotional night.
Of course it will.
Who the fuck ever thought that me and him would be on the stage at the O2? I mean, yeah, but we'll see.
I'm honestly so happy for you. I can't wait to be there. Pete, we are coming to the end of our conversation. What genuinely brings you joy now?
Oh, fucking hell. Um, it's a real cop-out answer. But the truth be, you know, I'm currently filming the second and third series of For Dog's Sake, which is, you know, this kind of dog show that it's taken me years to get off the ground. Mm-hmm. But nothing makes me happier than being around dogs. That genuinely mm-hmm. It's the contentment I feel is so, so special. But in terms of what is bringing me kind of joy at the minute, I'm still searching for that.
Mm. I think that's a very honest answer. Thank you. What does rising mean to you?
What does rising mean to me? Rising is understanding. Understanding where you've been, why you've been there, why you've done the things you've done, whether it be good or bad, and improving. Always trying to make sure you're better tomorrow than you were the day before. And you can only do that through a commitment to wanting to be better. Mm. You can only do that through wanting to help yourself, because you can't help anyone until you help yourself. You can't love anyone until you love yourself. And that is where I want to be and what I want to do. Rising is a feeling.
Mm-hmm. That's a very beautiful answer. Very poetic. But I genuinely hope that you see yourself for who you are. You are such a joy to be around. I know you might have made mistakes in the past, but who fucking hasn't? And I really hope you can just learn to make peace with that, because you needed all those experiences to get you to where you are today. And today you are helping so many people feel better. You're making an impact with everything that you're doing. And we love you.
I just want to tell you as well that I have known you for a couple of years now. And honestly, you are such an inspiration to so many people, but including me. And I genuinely, genuinely really admire you and everything you stand for. So equally, this is now like a little love-in. I hope you are as proud of yourself as I am of you.
Thank you. Oh, I love you. Oh my goodness. I really wasn't expecting to feel so emotional in that episode and so moved by it. I just adore Pete. I think he is such a good guy, and I just think you can really, he just really doesn't see it in himself. And I felt like I just wanted to hug him the whole episode, and not in a patronizing way. Just I just think he puts so much pressure on himself, and I think he is just a very genuine, incredible person. And I'm so honored that he was so vulnerable and open. And I know if you're not used to doing that, it's really not easy. It takes so much courage and strength. And I'm just deeply, deeply grateful to him for doing that. I really hope you guys enjoyed it, and perhaps you related to aspects of it as well. And we'd love to hear your feedback. We'd love to hear your thoughts. So please do leave a comment, rate the show, follow, subscribe, send me a DM, let me know what you thought. And yeah, just big thanks to you all for listening, and to Pete for being such an amazing guest on Rise with Roxy. We will see you next time.